You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need, something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic. There's no need to fear. We gotta let the whole world hear. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. And now, here's Rod Adams and the Atomic Show. It's atomic, yeah. It's atomic.
This is Rod Adams from Annapolis, Maryland. It's time for Atomic Show number 60. I have a guest with me. His name is N. Nadir. He's a diarist from the Daily Cause. I like to title this show A Liberal View of Atomic Energy. Liberal in the sense that both of us tend towards the liberal side of the political spectrum, and also liberal in the sense of a large dose. The show's a bit longer than normal, but I think you'll enjoy it. We sure had a good time talking.
That's my t-shirt.
I like it. I like it. It's a board game. I actually had several conversations with the man over the years. He's a member of ANS and was quite active probably until 98.
I sat next to him once during a presentation on Fermium.
Yeah.
Not Fermium, I'm sorry, Einsteinium.
Okay.
And it was like, it was just tremendous. It was an ACS meeting in American Chemical Society. In San Diego, and I kind of snuck away from my real job.
Yeah.
And went to the nuclear lecture.
Well, that was really his specialty, wasn't it? He was a chemist.
Yeah, he was a chemist. So it was really a thrill. You know, I was kind of I don't know. You spoke to him or?
Yeah. Oh, I had several conversations. He's a pretty interesting guy.
Yeah.
Like an awful lot of folks who were nuclear pioneers, he lasted a long time.
Yeah. He didn't die from discovering all of those elements.
You know, it's I actually have a list of all the people that were there at the start of the nuclear, you know, when CP1 started up.
Right, sure.
And it's amazing how many of them died in their late 80s and 90s.
Yeah. Beta lived to be 91. He just died recently.
Sure. Yeah. And Weinberg lived to be a ripe old man.
Yeah, well, he just died recently as well, so... Yeah, it's kind of amazing. Did you ever go down to Smithsonian and see the dollar sample?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they had one in the Baltimore Museum also. That was they had the battery. It was a
pacemaker battery.
1/200th of an ounce of plutonium, 238.
I didn't know that was out there. But,
yeah. It wasn't. It didn't have any plutonium in the battery at the museum. Just the case of the battery and showed the internals. It's pretty amazing. I've been fascinated by that ever since.
Yeah, well, you know, I have too. I mean, it's really been, I don't know how many of my writings you've read over the years, but it's been an area of immense fascination.
Yeah, I've read a fair number. You know, your writings are very interesting. Take a lot of time sometimes.
To read them.
Yeah. Well, to read them and then to read all the comments that you attract.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of fun.
Yeah. You know,
I think I've changed some minds.
How long have you been doing it?
Blogging?
Yeah.
It's really hard to say. I mean, it certainly goes back to, I think, shortly after the 2000 election.
Mm-hmm.
Really, it's kind of, it's sort of, as you know, many Democrats were extremely upset by the events of 2000.
Oh.
And really, I was searching around for my friend Ralph Nader.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't really acquainted with with blogging, you mm-hmm. know, that people did it or anything, but you know, sort of introducing myself to the idea. And, I just ran into some remark about Ralph Nader.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, I just posted. And I was kind of surprised that people responded to you and things. And very shortly after that, my other interest went towards the nuclear weapon.
Mm-hmm.
Because, as you know, many political liberals have a big problem with nuclear. I don't really understand that. But,
it's interesting to trace how that happened.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't always the case.
No, it wasn't. I mean, Weinberg, I assume you've read his... are we recording that?
Yeah, I'm recording it. Okay. Like I said, okay. I'll probably start and stop. And,
okay. Weinberg, as you know, he wrote The First Nuclear Era, and mm-hmm. a good part of that is about his liberal or leftist principles.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Oppenheimer was...
he was thrown out for being too far.
Yeah. 1954, he lost the security clearance. And so, I mean, there were a number of people I've written at CASA about Lise Meitner.
Mm-hmm.
There were a number of people who really came to it from a leftist perspective, in the sense that the real motivation for all nuclear technology was fear
mm-hmm.
of the Nazis, and fear of Heisenberg specifically.
Yeah.
And as a result, many people felt inclined to react to that, and people who were who feared being victims of fascism
mm-hmm.
certainly they were certainly not right wing people,
yeah.
and they were inclined to make this nuclear effort,
mm-hmm.
and it occurred to many people, including Weinberg, most famously, to build nuclear reactors for a non-war purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And so, initially the nuclear industry, with the exception of maybe a person like Teller, and I think even Teller was not really so associated with nuclear, with right-wing kind of approaches at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So many of the people who were involved really saw it as a potential threat. And,
right.
and many of the issues that you know now inform the nuclear world,
mm-hmm.
including the issue of so-called nuclear waste,
right,
occurred to the people of that time. You probably know that the Adams atomic engine pebble bed design dates from 1944,
right?
And it's not a new idea. It's not an idea that suddenly emerged out of some kind of concern for what the pressurized water reactor has been doing. And I regard the pressurized water reactor as an enormous success.
Mm-hmm.
For me, I don't want to play into the idea that we suddenly need something safer because there are very few things that are as safe as a pressurized water reactor.
And it certainly is, as a pressurized water reactor that is properly designed, that is operated by people who have been trained to operate, and it's not terribly complicated to operate a pressurized water reactor hooked to a steam plant. But as you say, from the very beginning of recognizing that atomic fission was a steady heat source, not something that was necessarily amenable to a cylinder engine, but a steady heat source, people said, well, I guess it would be a great heat source for a gas turbine.
Right.
I mean, and, of course, you know, 1944, that occurred to people. But at that time, gas turbines, the Brayton cycle, was fairly new from an industrial point.
Yeah, I think that's
jet engines came into being at the very end of World War II.
Right, so it's a related kind of technology. It's mm-hmm. a technology that, and only a small subset of available nuclear reactors have been explored.
So that
has to be said.
Oh. You know?
I mean, my orientation when I think about reactors is really molten salt
mm-hmm.
types of reactors. And my interest in the molten salt reactor has led me to realize that that's a really a class of reactors. Mm-hmm. It's really an infinite set of reactors. It's not one type of reactor. You can have a fast spectrum in a molten salt reactor. You can have a thermal spectrum. And the Weinberg's molten salt reactor was a thermal reactor.
Right.
Thermal breeder.
Right.
It was just a magnificent design.
Mm-hmm.
I think one that should be revitalized.
There's a few people that are interested.
It's the kind of it's part of the Gen 4 program. And I have seen a number of them that are oriented towards fast spectrum,
mm-hmm.
and I'm interested to see what kind of potentials, because from a chemist standpoint,
mm-hmm.
from a chemical standpoint, there's just an awful lot you can do with that reactor.
Because you can get to the fuel pretty easily.
You can get to the fuel pretty easily, and you can manipulate the chemical nature of what's going on in the reactor. Particularly with a thorium-based fuel cycle, with
mm-hmm.
233, the mass number 233,
right.
involved, you can in fact control, because the intermediate is protactinium,
right.
233, and that causes certain kinds of complications in how much fuel you breathe. You can actually remove it.
Right.
It has a 27-day half-life. You can set it over on the side, wait for it to become U-233, and then you can put it back in the reactor, or take it to another reactor.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that reactor is a pressurized water reactor or even your trees of fuel.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to stop for a second
sure.
and say this is Atomic Show number 60, and I'm talking with N. Nadir, a blogger who blogs on a regular basis on the Daily Cause. And one of the interesting things about N. Nadir is that he blogs about nuclear energy from the perspective of a social liberal.
Right.
And a political liberal.
Political liberal.
Which, for some reason, and we'll talk a little bit about that during the course of tonight's conversation, the people who are liberals have, for at least the last 20, 25 years, believe that one of the tenets of their political orientation is to be against nuclear power. At least some of them have.
Yeah, there are some notable exceptions, however, and Hans Bethe is the most famous.
Mm-hmm.
He's a Nobel laureate, and he never, ever moved away from his position in favor of nuclear energy. He was a tireless worker for
mm-hmm.
nuclear energy, and he was a political leader. So it has to be understood that that not everybody who has been liberal has. My own, I switched.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I started up until probably the time of Chernobyl. I was on the other side. I was
against nuclear.
I was against nuclear energy, and it was kind of the rote sort of thinking that you get. You know, there's a fair debate. About what is a political liberal, what is a conservative,
mm-hmm.
and that debate, I think, should not be construed as a set of opinions about set issues.
Right.
I think that some of the things that constitute liberalism are justifiably criticized,
mm-hmm.
And some of them are really essential to creating a future that we all want to enjoy. I consider myself an Eleanor Roosevelt liberal.
Okay.
Okay. And that means to me kind of a concern for all of humanity. You know, it's really kind of people associate it with a Christian view, but it's also really a cultural universal the so-called golden rule, which is to treat other people as you wish to be treated yourself. This doesn't mean that you coddle everybody. It doesn't mean either that that everybody's worthy of the concern that you give. So if you have a case of a person who's abusing, for instance, welfare laws,
right.
That doesn't mean that all welfare people are not worthy of their human dignity.
Right.
And for me, I want people to have opportunity, and very, very clearly, by a huge amount. I have an egalitarian background of my own. My father was a laborer. He never finished eighth grade.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that I was able to enjoy a decent lifestyle is because my country was wealthy. And as a result, there was really a filtering through the entire culture. My parents were not political liberals. My mother was sort of liberal. She was sort of a swing voter.
Mm-hmm.
And my father and I disagreed on many things. Archie Bunker sort of thing.
Well, he was an Archie Bunker conservative.
He was not a well-educated man. He was an excellent, he really was very skilled at arguing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think my own skills that have developed in my adult life really hark back to confronting my father on political issues. You know, mm-hmm. It was the time of communist, anti-communist kind of thing. And, my father called me a commie. Not that I was, but, but it's, but really the concern is for liberals that are important to me are things like the elimination of poverty and the sustainability of the future. And, also trying to, create an environment, an international environment that's conducive to peace.
Mm-hmm.
And, I think there's a lot of contortion.
Where we're not fighting over resources.
We're not fighting over resources, exactly. I mean, really, the resource issue Mohammed El-Baradei, the head of the IEA, makes a very famous speech about the power consumption in Nigeria, and it's 8 watts.
Mm-hmm.
That's the per capita power income consumption of electricity in Nigeria. And to me, this is an issue that concerns all of humanity. It's not something that's limited to, okay, I have my own problems here, and I live in New Jersey, so I have my own set of problems in New Jersey, and I'm not involved in these people in Nigeria or in Darfur. One of the interesting things that's happened in the nuclear renaissance is the interest in Africa,
mm-hmm.
in nuclear power. As you know, the South Africans are world leaders on the pebble bed concept, mm-hmm. which is not my favorite concept, by the way, but that we can talk about that. But it's a good concept, but there are certain things about it that I don't necessarily endorse, but it is a reactor that can be built simply,
mm-hmm.
and cheaply on a small scale, and provide for people in very dire circumstances. And South Africa is a country where there are a lot of people who are still impoverished. Nigeria has recently launched a nuclear program, and people look at that and they say, "Well, they're Nigeria," but they have a right to health and a future,
mm-hmm.
as much as any of us.
Yeah.
And these are the kinds of liberal principles that I see. And this is, this is why support for nuclear energy is very, very much consistent with my liberal ideas, because we cannot address the really exigent problems of the world without addressing poverty.
Right. Well, to me, one of the more amazing statistics is to think about the fact that the American energy consumption, I believe right now, is equivalent to having about 230 slaves operating for each one of us. If you convert the energy that we consume into what a human being can carry and do, you know, produce with manual labor, which does give us the ability to have an incredibly different standard of living than someone who lives in Nigeria or Angola or Chad or some other country that just doesn't have those resources. Now, of course, the sad thing about Nigeria is they do produce a lot of energy, but it all leaves the country. It's all concentrated in the hands of a very, very small number of people. And actually, that's one of the things that I have against the fossil fuel business. I don't have anything against fossil fuels themselves. They've been an incredible boon to human dignity. But the fossil fuel business has evolved into something where it is extremely concentrated.
No, that's very true. I mean, you know, another part of my perspective on nuclear energy as a liberal is an environmental perspective. Mm-hmm. Environmental issues are very important to me, and I fully credit what you say about fossil fuels. I'm less inclined to. I think that fossil fuels, we have to move past them.
Mm-hmm.
And there is no way. You can talk about Brazilian solar roofs or whatever you want to talk about and windmills and everything else, but there is no way to provide that energy without nuclear.
Right.
And the environmental reason for that, the environmental advantages of nuclear energy are enormous. And they've always been so.
Mm-hmm.
They've always been so. And it's unfortunate, I think, really unfortunate that somehow the idea of environmentalism has moved away from that fact. And the only way I can account for it is to say that nuclear materials are new, and people fear what they do not know. And
see, I come to it from a different angle. I think that people fear what they've been told to fear.
Well, yeah, I think that's true. That's true, but it's much easier to fear what you've been told to fear if you don't know it. If you are not aware of, in other words, if you cannot think critically,
right,
about what's being told to you. You know, when you look at these anti-nuclear websites, you see people who really seem to know something that maybe you feel you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
They'll occasionally lapse into this sort of techno babble about nuclear fission, and you'll even see multiplication factors mentioned, or you know, some kind of theory about the, or some description of the exotic nature of plutonium-240 and plutonium-239, and whether you can really get critical. And so, you know, people look at, and coming to it myself,
mm-hmm.
okay, as a person who did not know about nuclear energy, I kind of thought, well, you know, those guys are smarter than I am. They know something I don't know, so they must be telling the truth.
Right. See, that's where, you know, I am sometimes accused of believing I'm the smartest guy in the room.
Mm-hmm.
So I really, when it comes to nuclear power, it's hard for somebody to try to snow me, because mm-hmm. I have sure. studied the material in depth, and I have, you know, very personal, almost a friendship relationship with three different reactors that mm-hmm. I've, you know, been intricately involved in and operated, and I've seen what waste is, and mm-hmm. I've seen what the size of the reactors are.
And I haven't. I'm working on it.
Right. I've seen all that stuff. Yeah, so sure. it, you know, and of course, being a Navy guy, I sometimes have a rather crude way of saying things. I say, you know, don't piss on my head and tell me it's raining.
Okay? I like that. I'm going to steal that locution.
So, so, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, I read the websites and I, as someone who understands nuclear in a deep personal way, not just out of a book.
Sure.
And then I also listen to or read the writing from the viewpoint of someone who spent their college career analyzing writing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And what did the author really mean to say?
Right.
You know, many people, engineers don't like to do that. They think, well, the author said what he meant to say. No. Mm-hmm. You're a writer. You understand.
Right.
writers choose their words very carefully.
And I do.
Yeah.
I think this is really a problem, and this is why, you know, I have to tell you that when I first discovered the internet, my first thing to do was to start searching nuclear things.
Mm-hmm.
Because I lived in kind of this isolated sort of world, I didn't have experience with reactors. I only knew them I started with the table of nucleides in the handbook of chemistry and physics.
Mm-hmm.
So,
a big, thick book.
Yeah. There's pages, you know, about, three millimeters thick. That's a table of the nuclear properties of all of the nuclides. And
thin paper, too.
Yeah, it's thin paper. And my copies, both of my copies of the Handbook of Chemistry and Physics, are quite dirty from all the times. I'd wake up in the middle of the night and say, okay, what is it? A captured cross-section of strontium 90 and that sort of thing. But, so I began to think, because I was living in this very isolated world, I began to think, well, geez, some of my ideas are original, or this, why don't people do this, or why don't people do that? I became kind of a nut about it,
mm-hmm.
you know, the way to put it.
Yeah.
I could tell you.
So you have an atomic obsession also?
Very much so. So I have a personal relationship, I would say, with all of the fission products,
mm-hmm.
and all of the sub-fermium actinides.
Okay.
I can tell you something about the chemistry of all of the actinides.
So you don't like the word nuclear waste, or the phrase?
No, I think it's a ridiculous phrase. The word waste is a rather odd word in any case.
Mm-hmm.
If we're looking at a smoggy city, and we all had occasion to do that, we are looking at fossil fuel waste.
Right.
Okay. I've coined the term that's gotten some appreciation, nuclear exceptionalism.
Okay.
Which is the idea that things that occur in the nuclear case are only important in the nuclear case. So the issue of waste, for instance, as you know from a zillion years of talking about nuclear energy, whenever you say, oh, I think nuclear energy is fabulous, people say, what about the waste?
Right. It's a trump card. Throw it out on the table. Stop the conversation here.
And that's an absurd conversation because, to me, as a person who's very concerned about climate change, okay, and I take Mr. Gore's remarks and the remarks that generated his remarks,
mm-hmm.
which began, by the way, with Alvin Weinberg.
Alvin Weinberg, yeah.
Not really began, but in any case, I take those remarks very seriously. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that climate change is a very serious issue, possibly the most serious issue faced in our time, and it is a waste issue.
Right.
There's no other way to put it. Okay, carbon dioxide is a waste.
Right.
Okay, there's 5 million metric tons of commercial use for carbon dioxide. It's mostly used in the food industry, and we do consume coal waste when we drink Pepsi or Coke, not to mess on anybody's brand. But it is waste. Then the concept of recapturing carbon dioxide and using it rather than dumping it in some kind of repository is a concept of making use of waste.
Right.
And in fact, when you look at the living systems of the world, you quickly see that all waste cycles are cycles.
Mm-hmm.
The carbon dioxide is released by animals, it's collected by plants, it's reduced to a storage form of a sugar, and there's a whole bunch of biochemistry, and it comes back. And as we often, it's a cycle.
One man's trash is another man's treasure.
Right.
And the same, I mean, that includes animals, plants, et cetera.
Right.
Under that.
And in the nuclear case, there's really not really much of a better case. We talk of nuclear fuel cycles. We don't talk of oil cycles.
Mm-hmm.
We don't talk of coal cycles. We don't talk of silicon cycles. If we imagine that really... solar energy is going to work someday. And I have nothing against solar energy.
Well, solar energy works today.
Yeah.
It just doesn't
work
the job
scale.
that we needed to do.
Right.
So when we talk about these things, we do talk very much about a nuclear fuel cycle. And the fuel cycle itself is, there are a lot of them. The current fuel cycle is very primitive.
The once-through fuel cycle of slightly that's enriched uranium. Right?
Yeah, it's very primitive.
Right.
And, you know, for me, the question is, people say, well, what do we do with the waste? I say, let's keep it. And when you really look into the details, you find that it's enormously valuable stuff. You and I first corresponded about ruthenium mm-hmm. and rhodium, and there are many, many similar cases that we could discuss. But really, there are very few materials in spent nuclear fuel, and that's why I call it spent fuel, that are not useful. Mm-hmm. And the most useful of them all, of course, is the uranium. That remains. And the fission products themselves are all very, very valuable materials.
Right. I'd like to say that they're unique materials, or they're rare materials with unique physical properties.
That's correct.
And generally speaking, rare materials with unique physical properties have value.
Right.
And in many cases, there's no other source for them. I agree with you. I don't understand why, well, I do understand. I have my theories on why people insist on calling it waste. I know that, you know, Ralph Nader and his Critical Mass Energy Project back in the early 1970s got together and said the way we're going to constipate the nuclear business is to emphasize the waste issue.
Right.
You know, it was a strategy.
Yeah, I don't really, again, I don't understand, you know, I will confess to having a passing fascination with Nader, and it was sort of media-driven. But really, if you look into this guy, he's not necessarily a very serious person. He's a kind of paranoid, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And it's unfortunate that somehow he's become associated with environmentalism, because his environmental attitudes are very poor. Of course, the critical one is nuclear. This is a guy, who informed the world in 1977 that if all the world's nuclear plants were not shut in the next 5 years, there was going to be a massive civil war. I don't know. I mean, that's kind of crazy, you know, because the 5 year period passed, and in fact, we're now talking about a nuclear renaissance, as we should.
Right.
He
was also challenged on his claim that plutonium is the most dangerous substance known to man.
Yeah, and that's a really kind of bizarre. That's become an urban myth, and I've seen it written in the New York Times
mm-hmm.
And other places that plutonium is the most toxic compound, most toxic substance known. And of course, you're probably familiar with the works of Bernard Cohen.
Yes.
He got in trouble for challenging Ralph Nader to eat as much caffeine as he would eat plutonium.
Right.
And in fact, as a chemist, okay, I've worked with some very toxic compounds.
Sure.
My wife agreed to date me in spite of the fact that I was working with selenols, which are horrible smelling compounds. I've worked with some very, very nasty chemicals, including things that are war gases.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a respect for toxicity. And no one should stand here and claim that plutonium is a great substance to eat. But in fact, the world supply of plutonium was eaten. In 1944, a chemist named Don Mastic ate it,
mm-hmm.
accidentally. And the real concern at the time was just getting the plutonium back from his mouth.
Right, because it was right. Wait a minute.
We need this. You know, it was a microgram quantity. It was not really, I think it was barely a visible quantity. But, you know, I mean, he was writing about his experience in the 1990s.
There was at least 25 or so atom bomb workers from the World War II era, Manhattan Project era, and soon after that, that consumed on average, I think something like 4 to 10 times what is considered to be a lethal dose.
Yeah, but,
those guys were followed for years.
But you know, I think that you and I and maybe the nuclear community should move away a little bit from saying, "Well, okay, it's not." I think we're adopting Ralph Nader's criteria.
Right.
Okay. Because really, on a more profound level, you know, there are a number of things, our wealth, and the wealth that allows us to record this conversation on the computer and to have lights over us, involves many, many toxic trade-offs.
Sure.
And, you know, people of the environmental persuasion like myself, we love to talk about fluorescent bulbs. Well, these compact fluorescent bulbs, and they're wonderful. Unless you break them. They have mercury. You know, there is a trade-off. There's a risk that you take that you will break the bulb and you will ingest mercury. And there's another risk that by not having the light bulb, you will burn more coal and you will get mercury coming to you downwind from the coal plant that's burning. Now, you and I, of course, can replace all those coal plants with nuclear plants. So when we talk about the word safety, okay, we have to put it on a scale. Some really exciting and useful work has been only recently undertaken. And these are these famous and somewhat controversial ideas of life cycle analysis external cost.
Right. The externee study done.
Right, and I refer to that all the time in my writings, and I would like to see that process carried further, because you know, and I'd like even larger and clearer definition of the criteria, because one of the things you look at when you try to determine the external cost of nuclear energy, for instance, is the decay of the uranium in the nuclear reactor to radon.
Okay.
So this radon, which is found in people's basements, is found in my basement. I live on the Reading Prom.
Okay.
So this radon it's assumed that in X number of hundreds of thousands of years, this radon is going to find its way into the environment and someone's going to breathe it in. But of course, if you fission the uranium, then the external cost, it can't decay. You're eliminating a series of really, you know, 20 radioactive decays and really facing the decays of fission products. So you've cut away a lot of that risk.
Right.
So the assumed risk for nuclear energy, the external cost, even though it's very low compared to coal, oil, natural gas, and in fact, solar energy, it's really based on the criteria that inflates it.
Right. Well, there's also, I do a lot of cost-benefit analysis in my day job, and people forget about, it's not just analyzing the external costs of a technology. You have to determine what are the benefits of that technology and balance those two. And that's where I come, you know, I just can't get excited about the diffuse energy sources that require so many other pieces to allow them to provide some contribution to energy. You know, solar energy is exciting to a lot of people. I don't have anything against capturing the sun's energy, but if I have to build a large collector that I know is going to be useless to me for 12 hours a day minimum, and more like 18 hours a day in most times, then why bother? You know, if I know that. And I used to spend a lot of time sailing.
Mm-hmm.
I love capturing the wind and using it for energy, for a hobby.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't want to run a factory using the wind as my source of power.
Yeah, well, I'm not. I think in the nuclear community that you know we tend to dismiss renewable energy, and I think that the fight doesn't really originate with nuclear people. It originates more with renewable people who say, well, we can. And it's really funny because, you know, the first thing they want to replace with renewable energy is nuclear energy. It makes no sense.
Right. if you can use renewable energy, let's replace a few coal mines, okay?
Yeah. Right. So, but we do have to keep in the back of our minds, and I'm intrigued by Adam's atomic engines in this respect, because I think you model your engines as load following devices. Mm-hmm. But right now in the world of pressurized water reactors, they have an enormous capital cost. And as a result of that capital cost, you want to maximize your benefit. So I think solar energy has a real advantage in the sense that it's available at precisely the times that people would need it, which is on a hot, sunny day.
Well, actually, that's not true. See, solar energy is available precisely at a random time, mm-hmm. whenever the sun is available.
Right.
Okay? And the sun's not available even in a hot, muggy day. Sometimes it's overcast.
Yeah, that's true. That's
okay? True. And the sun availability may be close to the peak, but not necessarily at the peak. I mean, I think if you actually plot the curves from a electrical power demand, there's more demand at 3 o'clock in the afternoon on a summer day than there is at noon on a summer day, because it gets progressively hotter.
Yeah,
and people start turning more things on. But the solar energy is starting to go away by a sine wave function.
Sure, I fully concede your point. You know, and I mean, it's kind of absurd on some level to even talk about solar energy, and I make this point frequently, because it's not exajoule scale. And so you can talk to, it's got a talismanic value for people.
Right.
And from my perspective, looking at the external, I don't really care, you know, how many people, you know, build,
as long as they spend their own money on it. See, that's what drives me crazy about solar and wind power, uh-huh. is that the people that push that convince people it's a warm, fuzzy thing. They convince them to spend large quantities of tax dollars,
uh-huh.
on these things that aren't going to do a lick of good.
Uh-huh.
Really?
Well, I wouldn't say necessarily not a lick of good, because any time that a gas plant is shut, by any means, I consider that a happy event.
Well, the problem is, and again, I don't want to turn this
sure.
into an argument against two people who really
right.
agree
right.
on most things,
sure. Sure.
But a windmill, or even a bunch of windmills, requires some spinning reserve.
Absolutely.
Because in order to keep the electric grid operating at exactly 60 hertz, and exactly 120 volts, because that's what we demand for our systems, you have to have the ability to have a controllable source, and the wind is not controllable.
Yeah, I've actually written a diary on that subject of spinning reserve. It's one of my first cost
mm-hmm.
cost diaries, and it's about an Estonian study of it. So you should check that out if
okay.
you're interested in that idea. So I'm not fighting with you. So
right,
okay.
But
from my perspective, you know, I'm really willing. Again, to me, renewable energy has talismanic value. The real problem is not sorting. I say often to nuclear opponents, I say, when fossil fuels are all replaced, I would be happy to debate with you the relative merits of what has replaced them. Okay, but at this point, if you can get, because I think the issue of climate change is becoming very, very, very serious. And so, you know, if somebody builds a windmill and they do manage this spinning reserve problem, I don't have a problem with that.
Right.
You know, I mean, if you ask me, and you know, this is kind of going back to this liberal thing, okay, if you ask me what we should do, in terms of government interaction. I've said, I think we should spend $10 trillion of public money, if that's what it takes. Mm-hmm. Okay, $10 trillion, which is roughly equal to the United States GDP. Okay, and build, you know, however many thousands of nuclear power plants that takes. Mm-hmm. And I don't have any problem with that, because to me, as a liberal, I have no problem with government partnership in building infrastructure. Mm-hmm. I think that this is why the TVA, which is a nuclear utility, you know, some people have carried on a great deal about whether it's socialism or whatnot. The TVA, to me, the environment in which Weinberg functioned.
Don't forget who else is a big supporter of the TVA.
Mr. Gore.
Al Gore. Senior.
Senior, yeah. I mean, was it your website that had the picture of John Kennedy and Weinberg and...
I think it was Ruth.
Was it Ruth?
Yeah. I think it was Ruth. We support Lee Blog.
Yeah.
It's
a wonderful picture. Yeah. It really is. And
Kennedy was a big supporter of nuclear developments.
Yeah, you know, I think him and Scoop Jackson put together this the N reactor up in Warren. It's not my favorite reactor, and I think a lot of people didn't you know have problems with that reactor. But yeah, you're right. You know, I mean, the nuclear idea, nuclear energy is the newest form of energy that humanity has discovered. It really
by a long shot.
Well, we haven't discovered anything in the last two or three centuries other than nuclear energy. As a result, it really is kind of a new thing. I like to say sometimes criticizing conservatives that conservatism is the idea that nothing should be done for the first time. And, I stole that line from someone, maybe Churchill or something, but, so nuclear energy is a new idea. Okay. And, when we look at the Gen 4 program, we see a lot of new things. Mm-hmm. That have not necessarily all been proved.
Okay. Right.
I have no problem with
that. In some cases, though, we see things that have, the idea has been around for a long time.
Sure.
And even some early prototypes have been around for a long time. I mean, one of the things people forget is that the National Reactor Testing Station, which is now Idaho National Laboratory in Idaho, has hosted 51 different reactors.
Yeah, I recall seeing something like that.
I mean, and many of them were very different reactors.
Yeah, no, that's that's true. And again, even with those 50 reactors of different types, we've
only
got just scratched the surface. And I really think that the other thing that's happening is that we're accumulating nuclear materials. For the first time, we really can look at ton quantities of neptunium.
Mm-hmm.
We can look at ton quantities of americium. And it happens that that these quantities not only have energy value, an intrinsic energy value, but they also have they have important safety values,
mm-hmm.
especially with regard to the question of nuclear weapons proliferation. I mean, there are just a lot of excellent approaches involving the use of neptunium and americium
mm-hmm.
that can minimize. You can't uninvent nuclear weapons. That's not going to happen.
Right.
They're invented. You know,
the knowledge is there. The materials are there.
Right. So the best you can do is to minimize probability.
Mm-hmm.
And the best paths for minimizing probability and using... if you will, taking the swords and the plowshares, the Isaiah thing,
mm-hmm.
and accomplishing that is through the nuclear power. You cannot make weapons-grade plutonium go away.
It's you can't not, burn it.
You know, if you try to put it in the hole somewhere, it's still there.
Right, but you can make weapons-grade plutonium go away.
By fissioning.
Correct.
By fissioning. Right,
right. I mean,
but the other portion is that you also denature it. You
mm-hmm.
make it far more difficult to assemble a weapon. you make it far more difficult to maintain order.
Right. Well, I like to tell people that the place that I would like to see all weapons grade material be stored is inside a fission reactor.
That's another point we agree on.
I mean, the fission reactor is a great protective device for storing materials. And, oh, by the way, while you're storing it there, you get heat out.
And you know, let's speak up in defense of liberals here. The person who negotiated the treaty that now has exactly that scenario occurring. We do use Soviet era U-235 in our reactors.
Sure.
Is Al Gore. Okay, so he negotiated the treaty with the Russians that allowed, did you know that?
I'm trying to remember the name of the treaty, but I thought it had two senators' names on it.
No, actually, this was a Clinton-Gore era. I mean, when people said, okay, we're going to agree to disassemble nuclear weapons.
Non-looter.
No, that's another treaty.
Is it?
Yeah, that's another treaty.
I thought that was what was used to, or maybe non-looter is simply assisting the Soviets to secure their weapons material.
Yeah, that I think you're right on that score. And you know, I think non is, you know, is one of these guys that's running around saying, well, you know, we've got to secure all this nuclear material. I don't think it's quite as easy to build nuclear weapons as advertised.
Right.
You know, and certainly no one's going to take commercial fuel and do that.
Because, right.
If you're going to do that, you simply are going to enrich uranium, which is how the United States made its first nuclear weapon. The second one, well, the first one that was detonated was a plutonium weapon.
Right.
The first one that was used as a weapon, the Hiroshima bomb, did not involve the use of a reactor.
Right.
At all. So you can still do that. So since 1945, if you can find uranium, and it's everywhere, mm-hmm. including the soil of New Jersey.
That's where the radon comes from.
Right. If you can do that. Now, it turns out if you can actually denature uranium that's been mined.
Mm-hmm.
The thorium cycle produces uranium-232 and 233. 233 is the fissionable material. 232 makes you want to stand on the other side of the room and not get near it.
Or put some shielding between you. Time, distance, and shielding. That's what I was taught about this stuff.
So the 232, another interesting isotope is 236, which is not occurring. It's part of the thorium decay cycle. Much of the world's thorium originated as U-236, but it's not found. But you make that in a nuclear reactor. So when you take fuel out of a reactor that's been once through, you have this 236. And the processes for isotope enrichment depend very much on having only two isotopes, effectively. There's 234, but only having effectively two isotopes, which is 235 and 238. The minute you start introducing larger quantities of 234, which will come from the thorium fuel cycle, the minute you add 236, it becomes very, very difficult to isolate weapons-grade uranium.
Sure.
Okay. So, in theory, many millions of tons of uranium around. But in theory, if you really wanted to make uranium useless for making nuclear weapons, one way to do that would be to run it through a reactor several times,
mm-hmm.
all of it.
Right.
And there are large quantities of 238 sitting around. It's so-called depleted uranium. And that's an enormous energy resource.
Hundreds of thousands of tons in the U.S. alone.
Yeah.
And when you start running that and comparing that to the energy value of oil that's maybe left in the ground, it's mind-boggling.
It is.
How much of it is already mined? It's already up above the ground. It's already isolated from the other elements.
Right. It's startling. It's really startling. And in fact, if you look at the uranium, and I've done this calculation a zillion trillion times, if you look at the uranium in spent fuel that's actually been removed from the reactor, and although I've done the calculation a zillion times, I might be off a little bit, but I've determined that it's about 11 years of the entire Earth's, it's 11 years of the United States energy demand. Okay.
And we use nuclear fuel. I call it used rather than spent, because spent implies that there's nothing left in it.
You have a semantic point.
And I actually claim, maybe not a personal victory, but I claim that as a victory over the nuclear establishment that for decades they insisted on calling it spent nuclear fuel, and between me and a few other writers, we've convinced them that it should be called used. It's just used. It's not spent.
You have a point, and you know what?
And rather lightly used.
You'll probably see that on Decos if you read my writings in the future. Okay, because you have an excellent point. And, we have these kind of rhetorical touchstones that we use, and these touchstones are things like the word waste. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a loaded word.
Right.
Okay. And it's a word
that... dump is a loaded word.
Right.
That is a word that drives me crazy. When somebody calls a waste or a used nuclear fuel storage area a dump, I mean, it is... I've been there. It's not a dump. Okay? I've been to dumps. I know what dumps smell like. I know what the randomness of a dump
is. Hey, I grew up on Long Island. So right. You can't grow up on Long Island without knowing about dumps.
Well, see, I grew up in South Florida, and the only hills there are dumps. But, you know, I know the difference between a dump and a storage area.
Right.
And I also, you know, spent some time in a manufacturing environment where we very carefully segregated out things that we knew would be of value later,
right,
and stored them away. You know, some people would look at that and say, well, that just looked like garbage. But if you keep it segregated and you know what it is, you know, again, this material is stuff that we spent a lot of money on.
Right.
We made a lot of money in the plastics business that I was in, taking other people's byproducts, the sprues and the rejected parts and all that stuff, and grinding it up and running it through the machine again and producing good stuff.
Right, and that's exactly the same idea. And essentially that's really an environmental idea. Because I have an 11-year-old son, and so he comes home with these environmental reports that he has to do, right? And so they have the 3 R's, and they're all
reduce, reuse, recycle.
Yeah, but for me, you know, a big environmental sign, I go, well, what's the 3rd R, you know? recycle. And really, what's really interesting about nuclear materials is that the materials that are in there are available nowhere else. I keep coming back to those wonderful elements from the mass number 99 to 106. Element 99, of course, not known on Earth.
Technetium.
Right. It's an extraordinary.
Yeah, but that's the element that some people are all concerned about, because if you look at the waste form that people want to put into Yucca Mountain, if you stretch out sometime in the 10 to 100,000 years, technetium 99 produces the major dose. Who cares what happens in 100,000 years?
Well, I do. I actually do. There are a couple things about technetium that have to be. First of all, to me, it would be an unmitigated disaster. Okay, to either throw technetium away or to in fact transmute it, okay? Because you hear a lot about, have this National Research Council document before us. And
nuclear waste technologies for separations and transmutation.
Right. So, you know, there's all this wonderful stuff about transmuting technetium and making it go away. And that would just really be so unfortunate.
Is it useful?
Well, there are a number of things. First of all, the uses have not been fully explored. Okay. But at one time I had a conversation online, in my early days on the internet with a fellow, about technetium, and I said, you know, we should use this wonderful element. It's a refractory element. It melts at a relatively high temperature. It has properties, you know, Young's modulus and things like that, that make it very strong material. But it's also a catalyst. Below technetium in the periodic table is rhenium.
Okay.
Okay. There's long stories about rhenium and technetium. This wonderful chemist in Germany, the Nodax, who did this.
Ida Nodak was actually the person who first recognized that uranium was splitting.
You're absolutely right.
And she wrote the paper in 1934.
That's right. You know, I just saw that recently. And I didn't realize that because this is a person, and she got ridiculed.
Well, she was a chemist,
mm-hmm.
and she was getting into the world of physics,
right.
according to the physicist. And of course, she was also a female chemist.
Yeah. So. Her and Lise Meitner really got. What's interesting about her is that she was a remarkable chemist,
mm-hmm.
and she was the first chemist to isolate rhenium.
Okay.
And she had a husband, Walter Nodak, and she claimed to have discovered technetium, and she named it mazurium. That was the name that she gave to the element. And it actually destroyed her credibility. She was a marvelous scientist. I mean, there aren't that many chemists who discover elements.
Right.
Okay.
There's only 101, 102.
Well, we're up to up to 110. Okay. But you know, but everything beyond fermium doesn't count.
Right.
Because it exists
briefly,
vanishingly. So she discovered rhenium. Okay, and it is still a very very, very, very rare element. But rhenium is a very, very useful catalyst for certain kinds of chemical reactions that are very important industrially.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out that technetium has these, in many places can be substituted for technetium for rhenium, because rhenium is only available in a few metric tons on the entire planet. It's an extremely rare element. And we'd love to have hundreds of thousands of metric tons, but we don't.
Right.
Okay. We can accumulate as much technetium as we want. We have about 80 tons right now. But technetium does many of these things.
Is that 80 tons separated out, or is that...
No, it's 80 tons
inside
80 tons is some in spent fuel, some separated out. It's 80 tons.
Okay.
That's what exists.
Right.
And this is a very, very strong and useful material for alloying, but mostly for catalytic purposes. Okay. It is radioactive. Radioactivity is not enormous. Because anything that has a long half-life correspondingly is less radioactive.
Right.
So the longer you have it around, the less dangerous it is. And people forget that all the time when they hear these.
Right. Long half-lives means low activity levels because it takes a long time for half of it to begin.
But let's get back to this issue of Yucca Mountain and technetium. I want to turn to that
okay.
a little bit.
Sure.
The pertechnate ion is a soluble ion. It's one of the few forms I'm not going to say spent nuclear fuel, used nuclear fuel, that is soluble. The other solubility risk that we have is neptunium. Those two compounds are conceded to be the ones that are most problematic to contain for an indefinite period of time.
Right, if you assume all the other boundaries go away.
Right. However, there is a billion-year history of the behavior of these elements.
And Gabon.
At Oakland.
Oakland.
It's really fascinating. These natural reactors operated. And you can tell how far the technetium moved over the last billion years. And by the way, it was in a rainforest.
Right. Now, I had an interview, and I can't remember his name off the top of my head. I can go back and look. I did an interview with a guy who's a geochemist who said that the difference between Oklo and Yucca Mountain is that one is a reducing environment and one is an oxidizing environment. And if I remember correctly, the rainforest, because of it having all of the organic materials there, is a reducing environment. And Yucca is an oxidizing environment. Is that?
That
I'm not a chemist.
Okay.
You are, so please.
That's a fair statement, but there are several things. Okay. First of all, the protectinate ion is known. Okay. And it's, you know, it's not like this is some kind of mystery. You know, people go to Savannah River and they put technetium in the vatosome and they watch how fast it moves.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And all the time that it's moving, it's also decaying to ruthenium. Okay.
Right.
So if it takes 100,000 years for it to go, two meters or ten, and these are the kinds of numbers that you see, or even 100 meters, mm-hmm. okay, football field. If it takes 100,000 years, well, you know, the problem's kind of gone away, okay? So you're talking about some kind of theoretical risk.
Right.
Technetium, regrettably, okay, is migrating to the Hanford site right now. It's in the Hanford tanks, okay? And they know where it's going, okay? But the protectinate ion, it dissolves and redissolves, it reduces and it oxidizes.
Mm-hmm.
And it very much dependent on the kinds of things that it encounters. But it also adsorbs.
What is that?
That means it attaches itself to rocks. Okay? Everything in chemistry is geometry.
Right.
Shake. And it turns out that actually the electrons are shaped.
Okay.
They direct themselves in sort of corner, and they run into something that fits into them. They get held up for a while.
So now
you're left with, suppose some technetium gets out, and it does. Sellafield releases famously technetium into the North Sea. Then you start asking yourself the question: does it do anything? I wrote a diary, I don't know if you saw it, about radioiodine. You know, I mean, if you look at the Mississippi River, you can find I-129.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't come from nuclear weapons testing. It comes from Sellafield and it comes from lead. Okay? And so I went through this kind of elaborate calculation about what does that mean? What is the risk associated with that iodine? And when you go through the number, you find that it doesn't compare to the natural radioactivity you have from potassium. It's not even close.
Right.
You have to wait several hours to get a single decay in your thyroid from I-129 from Sellafield if you drink gallons of Mississippi River water every day.
Right.
Okay. At the same time, you're breathing cold waves. You know. How are we doing for time, by the way? I want to...
Actually, this is probably getting close to what we normally have for a single episode. And probably once I cut it down, it'll be about 45, 50 minutes. So.
Okay. And because I don't want to, you know, overstay my welcome.
I think that what I would like to do is say, man, I'd love to have you come back.
Okay.
There's all kinds of things that I want to ask you that we haven't got around to yet.
Yeah.
But, and as you may or may not know, I've lost my normal co-host, so I'm not asking you to be a co-host, but I need to fill in some time. So.
No, I didn't know you lost your co-host.
No, my normal co-host is a young man who did 59 episodes with me, and or the most of those, and he had to move on for personal reasons. So.
Okay.
Anyway, it's been great talking with you.
Yeah,
this is, you know, I'm just kind of come back and summarize. I can't really put myself into either a liberal or a conservative position. I care very deeply about people, about having opportunities, about not fighting over, quote, scarce resources when I know that E equals MC squared, and both of those are very, very large numbers. Energy is readily available around this planet, and with energy you can do so many things. You know, the problem of enough fresh water for people goes away if there's enough energy. The problem of enough food for people goes away if there's enough fresh water.
Right, absolutely.
And if you don't have those things to struggle over, people generally can figure out how to get along well enough to not shoot each other. They may still have disagreements. They may have to get out on a football field and knock each other around to take out some of their aggressions, but they don't necessarily have to fight. And, you know, having spent a career in the military, I have many, many friends and have watched many, many people get into fighting over scarce resources. And, I mean, one of my daughter's classmates is still sitting at Walter Reed Hospital with no legs.
Oh, that's hard.
So that's where I come from.
Okay.
And that's part of why I'm so excited about atomic energy. The reason I like atomic energy is not because I think they're the best, you know, I think that they are a competitive power source.
Yeah, I mean,
for particular markets.
In a future conversation, and I hope we do have one, I'd love to talk a little bit about this economics issue, because it's fascinating. And it very much involves questions about technology and theory. And these wonderful nuclear materials. Because it's not all in the void. And I have some ideas about those things. So yeah, let's kind of move this again.
Alright, great. Thanks a lot, Dave. And Nadia.
There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need, something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic. There's no need to fear. We gotta let the whole world hear. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic.
You're listening to the podcast network. Listen, learn, evolve.